Hey there, this is Seth Wars from Channel 9 coming to you from Building 10. There's been a lot of excitement about Linux user mode, and I thought we'd take a little deep dive on how this actually works, and I'll of course ask all of my dumb questions. I'm here with Deepu Thomas. Tell us what you do, bud.
Hey, I'm the dev lead for the Windows subsystem for Linux work. I am in the kernel team.
Fantastic. So let's start out with this. There's been some confusion that I've seen around, and maybe even that I've had, like, what really is this thing?
Yep.
Is it a VM? Is it not a VM? What's going on here? So I was hoping maybe you could help elucidate the entire
topic. So what we'll do is we'll try to explain some of the things that people are already familiar with, mm-hmm. but then we'll break it down into subcomponents, and then you can ask me questions as we go along.
Fantastic. Let's do it.
So you think about what we have today. We have a simple command line program called bash.exe.
Okay.
That is calling into a service which is something we call as the LX session manager service. And you think about two halves of the world. There is a user mode half, and there is a kernel mode half.
Okay.
And you have a kernel mode driver, which we call LXSS/LXCore. And you have processes in Linux, which is the user mode code from Ubuntu. So these are the rough breakdown of the components that make up the Windows subsystem for Linux.
Okay.
So the way it actually works is that this user mode code is encapsulated in something called a Pico process. And this Pico process is actually handled at the kernel level by a Pico provider driver that handles all the syscalls from the user mode to the kernel.
So let's take a step back, because let's pretend I don't know anything, which is going to be super easy for everybody. So let's start with that. You talk about user mode and kernel mode.
Yep.
Let's pretend I don't know anything about operating systems.
Yep.
What does that even mean?
So when you are at a higher privilege level, mm-hmm. or when you do a ring transition, that's when you enter the kernel mode. Mm-hmm. So user mode code typically runs at a lower privilege, mm-hmm. which means that you cannot do some of the operations, like you cannot go touch a PTE bit in memory manager when you are in the user mode. But you can do those things in the kernel mode.
Okay.
So programs that typically have to do low-level activity have to transition to the kernel mode and issue a system call to execute those privileged operations.
So let's just say I'm writing a C-sharp program, right? Yep. It's my point of sales application.
Yep.
What are some examples of things that will happen in my point of sales application that will switch out of my .NET area, which I'm assuming is user mode, that will all transition over to kernel? What are some examples of that?
Like file open would be a great example,
okay.
right? When you want to open a file, at the end of the day, the file has to go and hit the disk. The operation has to go and talk to the disk.
Uh-huh.
And the file system driver is actually implemented in the kernel mode. And so when you issue a user mode call, ultimately it transitions down to the kernel to actually do the physical writing to the hard disk.
I see. And then
at some point, there will be a call that will translate that file handle from the user mode down to something that the kernel can understand, and then issue the call to the file system driver, which can then talk to the disk.
And this is how pretty much all operating systems work. So there's stuff that I do that's just like I do computation, blah, 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 that's not going to happen. But whenever I need to open a file, then that's going to happen. Is there an example of something else?
And another example would be like you want to open something like you want to issue a context switch because the quantum of time for your thread has finished in the user mode. So at that time, the kernel dispatcher or the scheduler would come in and say, hey, your quantum of time has expired. Let me switch to a different thread.
I see. So if you're doing threading,
so asynchronous operations could also interfere, and you could be switching back from your context to some other thread that needs to get its quantum to run.
I see.
Yep.
So anything that has to do external, like for example, if you're typing the keyboard, there's going to be some interrupt that's going to be shot up.
Yep.
Or when you have to draw something on the screen, for example, anything that interferes or that does stuff with the device. So this is user mode. This is where our code runs. Anytime we do something with the physical stuff, it's going to go to.
Anything that needs a higher privilege mode that cannot be handled by the user mode privilege, you have to jump into the kernel to execute those code pieces.
Okay, so the second question is, you're saying that there's this user mode process.
Yep.
Is this something that's always running, or is this only happen when there is, you fire up bash? Is that a user mode process?
So let's walk through the creation.
Let's do it.
So when you run bash.exe, what we do is we fire some COM calls to this session manager service, mm-hmm. which then creates something called a Linux instance. Now this Linux instance could encapsulate multiple bash.exes. So you could be launching many bash.exe, but it would all be under one Linux instance for that particular user.
Okay.
And then what we do is we issue calls or ioctls into this driver to create the actual Linux instance. And from that point, we say, what is the program that you want to launch? And in this case, what we would do is you would say /bin/bash is the unmodified Linux binary that you want to execute.
I see.
So we load this program and start executing it just like how we would execute a normal Windows program. Uh-huh. But the difference here is that the Pico process doesn't have any subsystem components like Win32 components in it to actually need any Win32 equivalent support in the user mode or in the kernel mode.
So that's interesting, right? Because when you compile something, yep. let's just say I GCC something yep. in Ubuntu.
Yep.
When I do that and it does make system calls,
yep.
it's going to make system calls the Linux way, right?
Yes, that's right.
And these binaries have no idea about anything Win32.
That's correct.
So are you saying that when we're running this /bin, for example, /grep,
yep.
that's a Linux binary?
That's correct. It's an unmodified Linux binary, and when it makes a system call, we trap directly into the Pico provider mm-hmm. right here. So the Pico provider is able to handle those syscalls and then issue equivalent NT calls where it cannot satisfy the request on its own. So if it's a virtual concept that has no real NT way to do things, mm-hmm. then it can do it on its own. But if there is an equivalent NT call where it's just going to call it to
like
satisfy
open
the
file.
It would just issue that call and then return back, and then it would go back to the user mode.
I see. So this session manager, is it always running, or is it only running the first time you run your bash.exe?
So today what we do is we make the service demand on start. So only when you run bash.exe, it gets trigger started.
Okay.
And we auto stop it if there is nobody using it for like 5 minutes. So we try to minimize resources on the machine by saying, don't start unless somebody needs you, and stop when somebody stops needing you.
I see. So you run bash.exe, yep. the session manager starts,
yep.
it runs bash.
No, it actually spins up a Linux instance.
Okay.
And then in that context of the Linux instance, we spawn a process which typical Linux users know as init. Mm-hmm. And then init spawns bash.exe.
In that case, it's no longer bash.exe, right?
It's bash. It's bin/bash.
Got it.
Yep.
Okay, so let's talk about this little Linux instance. Is it like a VM? Is it a what is it?
So a Linux instance is nothing but an amalgamation of Pico processes that we tie into as one instance that is specific to a particular user.
Would this be analogous to what a container is?
It is very similar to a container.
Okay.
In that there is an isolation mechanism for this so that in the future you could have multiple Linux instances, each separate from each other. So you could be running a workload on one Linux instance, and you could be running a completely separate workload on another Linux instance, and you could have that container level of isolation between them.
I see. And so when you run the first bash.exe and
yep.
you run the second, there's a second Linux instance for
no,
each?
No. For today, we run them all in the same instance.
I see.
But what I'm saying, in the future, we could say, look at this and say, you want to have that degree of isolation. So you want to separate between them.
I see. So the first time you run bash.exe, you run it up. There's
yep.
certain PIDs that you're running. Let's
yep.
just say you're running sed and it's yep. taking a long time to
yep.
do something. That's going to be in the Linux instance.
So you could be technically killing one bin/bash from another bin/bash because they are all running in the same Linux instance.
I see.
But if you were actually in its own separate instances, you could technically think of them as separate containers and they are isolated from each other.
Okay, so let's see if I understand. So I run bash, I run another bash.
Yep.
If I run PS in one and PS in the other,
you would see the same thing because they are all running in the same Linux instance.
And PS, for those that I just remember this
yep.
because it shows all the running processes
yep.
as a command. So I see that there's the analogous, if you have a file call, it's going to call into here and say, oh, this really means this in the NT kernel.
Yep.
There are certain system calls in Linux that I know don't work in Windows,
yep.
like fork.
Yep. So we have a version of fork that we have always existed in NT.
Mm-hmm.
And what our subsystem code actually does is it invokes the for call that we have already implemented in NT to simulate the same behavior that Linux has.
I see.
Yeah, this might be a good point where Nick can actually come in and explain to you more details around the Pico process.
Oh yeah, awesome.
And actually get into details of things like fork, because we can talk about how we exactly implemented fork.
I love it. So yeah. We'll make sure to wait for Nick on this. Yeah. So the other question I have is, are there things in LXSS or LX Core
yep.
where you had to sort of do it all here, where you couldn't go to the
So where there is an instance where there is no equivalent on Windows, like there is certain metadata that we would have to say represent on top of NTFS, mm-hmm. right? So the permission structure of Linux is different from the permission
right.
structure of NTFS. So we would be writing those metadata elements into an extended attribute on the same NTFS file, but NTFS would not treat that metadata for permissions.
Mm-hmm.
But LXSS would treat that metadata for permissions.
So that's like the chmod plus
yeah.
6,
so if
7,
you were 7, chmodding something, that extra data would be handled primarily by LXSS, because for NTFS, it's just yet another extended attribute, which it thinks that somebody knows how to handle. And that somebody in this case is LXSS.
I see.
So there are things that only LXSS knows, but it is built on top of NTFS, so we get the rich advantage of making sure that we can interop between them.
Now, that's interesting, right? Because as I'm thinking about this now, maybe those that are watching,
yep.
you're looking at this layer that effectively becomes the kernel of Linux.
Yep.
How do you write that?
So this is written in standard C.
Mm-hmm.
And for practical purposes, what we did is we prioritized the system calls based upon the scenarios that we wanted to deliver.
Uh-huh.
And for the first release, we prioritized the command line tools that Linux had. Mm-hmm. And so we looked at 350 system calls that Linux had and looked at the ones that actually people who wanted these command line tools needed to be lit up. And so we prioritized those and we re-implemented them clean room without looking at any Linux kernel code so that we can actually take this code and ship it with Windows.
So effectively, were you just like looking at the man pages or something?
We were looking, our program managers helped us look at the structures and the interfaces that these calls do uh-huh. from the user mode, because Linux has a rich tradition of maintaining that the user mode to kernel mode, the interface remains a constant even though the kernel versions keep advancing. So we were able to document the interface and then use that interface to write the code that made LXSS possible.
So literally, you effectively abstracted the Linux kernel
yep.
via their interface.
That's correct.
And so when people say something like, this is Cygwin,
yep.
can you explain why it's not even close? I mean, I'm starting to get an understanding why,
yep.
but why is it not the same?
So Cygwin is a very traditional Win32 process. So what they do there is they take a Linux code base, like Bash, and they actually port it over to Windows,
mm-hmm.
which means that the binary that physically runs is a Win32 binary, which means that if you want to port a new application like Redis or any new construct that doesn't have an equivalent on Windows, you'll be going through the same porting exercise.
I see.
So the advantage that you get through this Windows subsystem for Linux is you want to download a new binary, you go do the traditional thing like you apt-get that binary or the package in, and it natively runs rather than you go through a porting exercise and then you go through a maintenance exercise of keeping that port alive.
Because effectively what you've done is you've made everything Linux portable, because effectively you've made an OS, I don't know if the word shim is right, but an OS shim that redirects everything as if it were Linux.
Yeah, we think of this as an emulation translation layer.
Got it.
That actually takes the system calls from Linux and re-implements it using NT constructs.
I see. So this is interesting to me, because it feels like you effectively lifted like Linux's arm, and anytime you eat something, it goes into this and makes it look like it's a Linux sort of stomach
yeah.
processing everything.
I mean, there is this popular terminology where folks like to call it as GNU/Linux, because most of the tools that run on top of the Linux kernel are GNU tools.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal in our first release was to see whether we could get those GNU tools working on top of LXSS so that we'd have near fidelity to people who wanted to use sed and awk and the rich tools that the command line interfaces in Linux have.
So effectively, I know there's a finite list of system calls into the kernel.
Yep.
Did you get through the whole list, or are there things
not
that we're still
yet
working on?
So this is still a work in progress. And while we have made a fair degree of progress in getting many scenarios lit up, we still have a bunch of system calls that we have to implement. And so what we have done there is we have sought feedback from users, and we have been super thankful that users are giving us that feedback. And using that, we are prioritizing which system call should we implement next.
I see.
And that way we know Ruby needs send file 64. If so, can we actually go implement that so Ruby behaves better using the subsystem for Linux?
So here's another question. Are there some things that people, because I mean this came out I think last week.
Yep.
Are there some things that you've seen people do that you're like, wow, we're devs, right?
Yep.
And all of a sudden we're like, oh my goodness, it works, and we get all excited,
yep.
even though we know it's supposed to work.
Yep.
Was there something that you saw that people did that you're like, holy cow, it works? Oh,
yep.
Of course it works.
I mean, one of the things that we were pleasantly surprised was people running perf benchmarks on Windows subsystem for Linux, because this was super early, so we didn't expect people to be running benchmarks, and finding that in many cases, at least for CPU-bound workloads, there is near fidelity in terms of performance between a native Linux implementation versus us was actually very gratifying. We had spent a lot of time making sure that compile time performance versus Cygwin is actually to our advantage, simply because we have very thin layers of code between what the user mode code wants and what the kernel mode code implements. But that was one area where we were happy to see people were running perf benchmarks, actually hitting some good numbers.
So you're saying that CPU bound stuff was really good.
Yep.
Is there improvements that we can make on the other subsystems,
yep.
like memory and
so pop? The disk is an area, or the file system is an area where we are continuing to work. And so we are trying to see whether can we improve the performance of disk benchmarks as well, so that we get to closer to native performance, so that people won't need to actually spin up something else to run a Linux workload.
That's amazing.
Yep.
So can you give me an example of some big programs that are traditionally Linux,
yep.
that work in this mode already?
Like something like Ruby is an example of a program that people have ports on Windows, but you know, if you run it on.
Yes, man, it's a pain. I tried to install Ruby the other day,
yep.
and I had to do this crazy thing, and then I had to go into this other thing, and it was pretty crazy.
Yep.
So you're saying that.
Like Python and Ruby, things that people are very familiar with, and they have all these extension points that make it really useful, right? The program alone has got a lot of value, but it's the contributions of users to it that makes
right.
the ecosystem more viable.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage of this approach is you don't have to individually port each extension point. So if we get the base implementation done, we get the richness of the ecosystem to use this approach rather than individually graft each one into Windows.
I see. So everybody knows that this is still early and we wanted people to get
yep.
a feel for it. Is there areas of the subsystem where we're like, hey, there be dragons there.
Yep.
Be careful.
So the pseudo-terminal implementation is something that we got great feedback from our users.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be something that we will be focusing on going forward, so that people can run things like SSHD,
mm-hmm.
which relies a lot on a good pseudo-terminal implementation,
mm-hmm.
which we don't have today. But that's feature work that we definitely want to accomplish in the future.
Awesome. So if people are watching this and they now have an understanding of how this stuff is working,
yep.
where can they go to sort of give feedback? I know there's already blog posts out there on
yep.
how to turn this on, and
yep.
so we'll put this below so you can get it turned on.
Yep.
Where can they go to submit sort of questions, features, bugs, etc.?
So we have a user voice page that we link from our MSDN.
Okay.
Blogs that have come out first, where people can upvote features that they absolutely think are important to support. And we also have a GitHub place where people can submit bugs to us.
Okay.
So we have been, my team has been personally looking through each one of those bugs and trying to see which ones can be prioritized based upon things that are easy to implement versus things that we should support long term, as well as looking at user-wise from a different scenario perspective to see which ones make more sense to light up now versus future, right? So it's been an amazing ride.
So tell me, has there been a bug that you're just like, whoa, what are they trying to do? Oh, wow, that's interesting. Has
yep.
there been anything like that?
So one of the things that people hit right away was that they didn't find any networking support when they installed Bash installed, but there was no networking support. And it was unfortunate, but we found that in many cases, people had IPv6 DNS entries that did not have a real route to go out of the machine.
Uh-huh.
But because Windows retries on the second and the third DNS entries, people never noticed it. But for some reason, we were only looking at the first entry. And if that first entry was actually broken, there was no networking for you.
That's interesting.
So we are fixing those bugs, and hopefully people should see that their networking will work in subsequent insider builds.
That's I had to write for my graduate class, I had to actually implement, it was called Yalnix, and it wasn't even all of Unix. And I remember thinking, holy cow, this is a lot of work. You effectively are recreating what Linux would be like on the kernel mode.
The huge value here is the number of system calls from the kernel mode are much smaller to previous work that have happened, like the services for Unix, which tried to mimic or map user mode APIs through NT constructs, which is a much larger surface area.
Of course.
And so because the kernel footprint is much smaller, we hope that we will be able to get to a higher degree of completion than previous attempts at this problem.
Well, I'm impressed. Okay, thanks so much for
spending some
time with us, my friend. Thanks so much for watching and learning about the Linux bash on Windows and how it actually works. Again, if you have any questions, put them in the comments below. These gentlemen and other engineers that are working on it are very excited to get your feedback and your input. Thanks for watching. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Thank you.